My name is John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And what I'm going to do is ask Rick, he can actually help me if he would, get these out to people. We have three programs coming in November. Anthony DeStefanis is going to be here from Otterbein University in Ohio to talk about the Ludlow Massacre. And for those of you who might be unaware of the Ludlow Massacre, in 1913-14, there was a major Colorado mine war, and a number of women and children were killed when the Army National Guard basically stormed the striking workers' tent village. And very, very famous labor conflagration and very famous event in labor history. So Anthony's going to be here to talk about that on November 9th. On the 16th, we're across the street in the library where Sparky and Rhonda Rucker, who are from East Tennessee, are going to be up here talking about changing the world one song at a time, songs of work and struggle. That's going to be basically a musical brown bag, which is always great. And last but not least, at the end of November, Dylan Miner is going to be here from the Residential College here on campus to talk about the General Motors strike, and in his way, the general strike, reflections on the Flint sit-down strike and anti-capitalist art. Dylan's a very interesting artist, professor, and other things over at the Residential College, so please do come back for those three. Today, we're very happy to have Tom Marvin back with us. Tom is with the American Studies and English departments at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And last time Tom was here, he was talking about Joe Hill. But when Tom and I have been in recent conversations about his work and everything else, he was telling me a lot about work he's now doing in relation to student activism and labor activism, really trying to put those into perspective. So today, Tom is talking on the topic, Occupy the University, putting student and labor activism in perspective. So please help me in welcoming Tom Marvin.
Thank you very much. Thanks, John, for inviting me back. I always enjoy coming up to Michigan State. This is my third time now with the Radicalism Conference where we first met, and then the other brown bag, and I always enjoy myself when I come up here. It's always fun. I'd like to start by unpacking my title from back to front. So if it's not what you expected, you can head for the exits. Although with such a small crowd, I really don't want to encourage anybody to head for the exits. I'll start with my perspective. My perspective on the issue is shaped by a lifetime in academia, including I took part in the successful struggle for a graduate student union at UMass Amherst in the late 80s, early 90s. And I've been teaching at IUPUI in Indianapolis for the last 20 years, which I can't really get my head around, but it's true. And for the last 7 years, I've been the director of the Sam Masarakia Scholars Program. And this is a scholarship program that provides full in-state tuition and fees for students who are interested in studying labor and community organizing. And it was endowed by a former steel worker who was an organizer for the steel workers and then who was a community organizer in his own community. And so when he gave the university this bequest, we decided to put it to work to honor his legacy by training the next generation of organizers. And so a lot of what I'm going to talk about today comes out of my work coordinating the scholarship program and trying to get my students involved in the labor movement in Indianapolis and on their own campus as well. So my perspective on the issue is also shaped by my belief, which I don't think is unique to me, that public universities and indeed all of public education are under a concerted attack now by neoliberalism, with its demand that all human activities justify themselves based on a narrow conception of profit and loss. And I believe that unless this trend is reversed, we'll be left with an educational system that's little more than vocational training and a public sphere that's limited to exchanging goods and services for cash. I think that's where we're headed. Now, most of the recent writing on student and labor activism, or much of it anyway, has focused on the campus as a training ground and as a proving ground for labor organizers later on. And people have debated whether that's a good idea, whether it's a good idea to take recent college graduates and get them organizing low-wage workers and put them on the fast track to union leadership. But that's not the question that I want to deal with today. I want to look at a different question. In my mind, it's more important to ask, given the seriousness of the attacks on public higher education, how can students and labor unions work together on broad-based campaigns to win major victories affecting the affordability of public higher education and the working conditions of everyone employed at the university? Okay. And when I say university, I'm referring to public universities, which have traditionally served working class students and provided opportunities for individual advancement. And at least once upon a time, they were intended to be open to all qualified candidates. Now, Occupy. Okay. When I first submitted a title to John back in the spring, he told me, no, it's not catchy enough. It needs work. And he was right. I can't even remember what it was now. So at the time, you know, the whole Occupy thing, we were still hearing the reverberations of that. And I thought, Occupy the University, that'll get people's attention. Well, now, you know, you get to this point a year later and people are saying, well, hasn't the whole Occupy thing peaked and passed? And wasn't it a failure? Well, I'm going to argue that the Occupy movement was just a precursor to a new social movement to reclaim the public sphere and to refute the notion that market forces should drive social policy and to create a more just and equal society. What does it mean to occupy? Why should students and labor try to occupy the university? And what lessons can we learn from Occupy Wall Street and the other encampments? But before answering these questions, we really need to take a look at who has already occupied the university. Christopher Newfield tells the story of the conservative attacks on public higher education in detail in his book, Unmaking the Public University, The 40-Year Assault on the Middle Class. And of course, many others have covered the same ground. I'm not going to go into details because I want to concentrate on what we can do in response to this attack on the public university. And I suspect that most of you are already familiar with the broad outlines of this attack, but I think a quick overview will help us to understand the problems that we face. Okay. Newfield's book is useful because he connects what often seem like disparate stories. Affirmative action, the culture wars, the decline of the humanities, the funding crisis in public higher education. He connects all of these back to a concerted campaign by conservative elites to maintain their power in the wake of the social upheaval of the 1960s and the 1970s. He argues that public universities of that period were poised to create a new multi-ethnic middle class with the potential to replace capitalists as the managers of social and economic life. Now, he analyzes the history of higher education over the next 40 years as part of a long counter-revolution waged by the conservative elite to weaken the middle class by attacking the institution that created it, the public university. The state university of the 1970s stood outside capitalism and often seemed anti-capitalist in its insistence on social justice, human dignity, and personal development. The task of the culture warriors of the 1980s and the 1990s and the other propagandists for the right was to subjugate the university to capitalism by evaluating its contribution to society in narrow market terms, by replacing liberal education with specialized training, and probably most importantly, by shifting the costs from the public, from the state, to students. and then restricting access to higher education and using the scarcity as a wedge between students of different ethnicities. The most important and obvious result of these attacks has been the decline in public funding for higher education. Once you can succeed in convincing people that higher education isn't a public good that contributes to the well-being of everyone in the state, that it's more of a private good, that it's only something for the individuals that are taking advantage of it, then it's pretty easy to get people to say, we need to cut back here. So if you take a look at the state support for higher education, in the mid-1970s, $10.50 per $1,000 in personal income went to public higher education. Now, this is a nationwide figure, an average of all the states. And of course, state funding varies greatly from state to state. Now today, we're down to $5.90 per $1,000 in personal income that's devoted to public higher education. You can see it's been cut, I mean, almost in half during that period. The corporate occupation of the university is seen most strikingly in the rise of a corporate administrative class that seeks the power and claims the perks of their privileged brethren, the CEOs, outside the university. Much has been made of administrative bloat as a major cause of increasing educational costs, but more important to our topic today is the replacement of any semblance of faculty governance with a top-down administrative style that Gay Tuckman, in a recent issue of Academe, calls the accountability regime, the politics of surveillance, control, and market management disguised as scientific administration. Huge increases in professional staff mean that administrators don't need faculty to help them run the university the way they used to. All too often these days, administrators and boards of trustees decide on university policy and then convene faculty committees merely to ratify the decisions that they have already made. And if you take a look at the numbers here, I think it's pretty striking. From 1975 to 2005, number of administrators increased 85%. Professional staff increased by a whopping 240%. Now, of course, professional staff also includes people like IT people. Okay? Obviously, in 1975, we didn't have many computer people on campus. Now we have many. But a lot of this professional staff is administrative staff doing the jobs that used to be done by faculty or in collaboration with faculty. Meanwhile, the full-time faculty has increased 51%, keeping the ratio of faculty to student more or less the same. But the part-time faculty in the same period has increased 311%, as I'm sure you're all aware, making most faculty members these days contingent, part-time, poorly paid, no benefits, and really taking a lot of the power away from faculty. Okay. Cutbacks in state funding have forced administrators to seek other funding sources in addition to increasing tuition, including private philanthropy and research grants. Newfield, in his book Unmaking the University, demonstrates that private donations can't begin to make up the difference for the lack of state funding. And not only that, they tend to flow to the universities that are already the wealthiest. So the endowment of the rich universities goes up, whereas state universities, although they put a lot of effort into fundraising, don't really compete. Multi-million dollar research grants in the sciences, Newfield points out, actually cost the university money. Although they're often touted as bringing money into the university, they need to be matched by investments by the university. Very rarely do they cover the indirect costs entirely. And so the university ends up subsidizing these grants and very often taking money away from teaching in other fields. Okay? Lately, cash-strapped administrators, fearing a public backlash if they raise tuition again, have been turning to privatization agreements, long-term leases that turn bookstores, parking, and food services over to corporations for 30 to 50 years in exchange for a one-time payment. Of course, these schemes are in reality nothing more than a disguised tax, not only on students, but also on the faculty and staff who also use these campus facilities. And of course, borrowing a page from the corporate playbook, administrators keep labor costs down by hiring temporary faculty at poverty wages with no benefits or job security. The cumulative effect of the corporate occupation of the university has been to weaken the effectiveness of public universities as avenues of upward mobility and inclusion for minorities and the poor, undermining the notion that educating everyone is good for everyone. And I believe that this radical attack on higher education, and indeed on all public institutions, requires an equally radical response. And that's where we get to the Occupy movement. Now, of course, many pundits were quick to call the Occupy movement a failure recently. You know, if you look for that on Google, you'll find 20, 30 different articles and saying why it was a failure, they messed up, saying a lot of the same things. And it's easy to see that, obviously, if you take a look at it. If you were thinking that the Occupy movement was the beginning of the revolution, then you were disappointed, and it looks like a failure. But it looks a little more successful, I argue, if you look at it as part of the long preparation for the revolution, the change in people's minds that needs to happen before you can get a real social movement going. So my question is, what can we learn from the Occupy movement that will help us to take back our public universities? And I think one of the most obvious things, is the power of simple, compelling rhetoric. Everybody remembers the 99% versus the 1%. Now, you can argue about how accurate that is, but it was effective. It got people's attention, and it taught them a very important basic fact about our economy today and got that into the conversation. But what I would say is that we need to go beyond slogans to create counter-narratives to the simplistic discourse of neoliberalism that tries to reduce everything to economic relations. Okay. Now, of course, the tactic of physical occupation was a huge part of the movement, and I think what this reminds us when we're thinking about how to organize is the importance of location and also the dangers of an open-ended occupation. Now, if Saul Alinsky were alive today, he would have called occupation a terminal tactic, because it failed to arouse the reaction that's essential for the development of conflict. Like any tactic, occupation can only be effective if the disruption is great enough, the demands are specific, and the target of the demands is in a position of power to grant those demands. And of course, the Occupy movement really failed on all three of those. Because if you don't have that, otherwise it just becomes a waiting game. How long can you sit outside in the winter? You know? Or becomes a target of police repression. And I think it's interesting that the Occupy movement, when it began to really catch on steam, was when it was greeted with harsh police repression. That was the one time it did provoke a strong reaction from the establishment. And that, you know, gave it some strength. But ultimately, the Occupy camps failed to disrupt business as usual, and they did not put forward specific demands to a target that could grant them. Commonplace. However, some of these limitations of physical occupation can be overcome when the location shifts to a university campus. Just look at the history of disruptive occupations during the 1960s, taking over administrative offices and getting concessions. Take again a look at the student movement in Quebec, where a massive movement of students and faculty got together and reversed the province's plan to raise tuition. That was successful. One advantage that students, faculty, and staff have is that they have easy access to areas of the university where disruption would hinder business as usual. And campaigns can be built around specific issues that directly impact large segments of the university community, leading to specific demands that could be granted by administrators and boards of trustees. Of course, in addition to offering opportunities for disruption and the development of specific demands, universities have traditionally been places for the free exchange of ideas, critiques of authority. And although this very role is under attack by neoliberal forces, the ideal and the practice remains. And of course, the Occupy camps promoted free education for all. The public university at one time came close to realizing this goal, and I believe it should embrace it again as a goal, free tuition. Because if tuition is not free, you really don't have access for everyone. That was part of the Quebec movement, and I think it's something we need to get back to, too. And I think you also need to invite the community onto the university campus. I mean, we were talking before we got started today, during the 60s, about people from the town coming onto campus, those connections. Too often, the university is walled off from the community. We need to get these together. Perhaps the biggest advantage that public universities offer as a site of occupation is the fact that students and recent graduates were a large part of the Occupy demographic, and they faced two compelling issues: student loan debt and poor prospects for employment after graduation. I mean, I'm sure those are the concerns that you hear about from students here, just as I do down at IUPUI. And of course, the thing is, both of these problems arise from a single source: the corporate agenda, the neoliberal ideology that makes maximizing corporate profits the only legitimate activity. We've already seen how public higher education was redefined as a private good rather than a public good, which led to a massive shift in the cost of education from the states to individual students who were forced to take out loans to cover those expenses. Now, from the neoliberal point of view, this is a big improvement, because not only do you lower taxes, but you also create a source of profit for private corporations, for the banks, and of course, you know, government guaranteed profit. And for students and families, the same situation is a disaster, as recent graduates stagger under huge debts into a job market that provides very few good entry-level jobs. Currently, more than half of recent college graduates are either unemployed or underemployed, meaning that they're working in a job that doesn't require a college degree. And of course, this is what I see with my students who are still doing the jobs that they were doing to get through college after they've graduated, still waiting tables and that. The relentless drive to maximize short-term corporate profits, regardless of the social costs, has led to shifting manufacturing jobs overseas and outsourcing the jobs that are difficult to move, creating an underclass of perma temps who make just above the minimum wage and never qualify for benefits. As more and more white-collar jobs are outsourced, our graduates face drastically reduced prospects for employment. And the result of all this, of course, is the shocking income inequality that we see, diminished prospects for all but a few young people, widespread poverty, and ironically, given that the whole thing is run by businessmen, a huge loss in productivity for the economy as a whole, as opportunities for higher education are withdrawn from a whole segment of the population. Okay, so enough about what's wrong. I'm sure I've really depressed you by now. My title focuses on student and labor activism, but there's actually a role for everyone connected to the university in the battle to undo the damage that the corporate agenda has caused to higher education and society in general. And so I want to start with the role for tenured faculty. By virtue of our relatively secure positions and our access to other segments of the university community who need to come together if we're going to accomplish anything, faculty have a unique position and a unique role to play. We need to engage in what Paulo Freire called critical pedagogy, in which literacy is recognized as more than preparation for a life of work, where it's seen as it's informed by an understanding of social forces that rule and shape our lives, and it leads to self-determination and civic engagement. But of course, I realize that, you know, along with critical thinking, these are all the buzzwords that we hear all the time anyway, right? Everybody says that, but I would argue that they're, lately especially, they're honored more on paper than they are in action. What I say is I agree with Henry Giroux, who says that what we need to do really is to link critical thought to collective action. Okay, we can all point out what's wrong, we can bemoan it, but until we take action, nothing happens. If the goals of critical pedagogy are going to be realized, tenured faculty need to connect the dots by explaining how different problems are related to the neoliberal agenda, and they also need to connect the people, to connect the different facets of the university community, the faculty, the staff, the students, all the employees, and also the community as well, both inside and outside the university. Okay. We need to show that outsourcing is everywhere. The decline in full-time tenured faculty and their replacement by part-time contingent faculty is the same as outsourcing, basically. It accomplishes the same function. It reduces good jobs to lousy jobs, and it has an exact parallel with the outsourcing of campus facilities, food service, maintenance, and bookstore jobs. In the new corporate university, faculty and janitors have more in common than ever. And I think it's time we need to wake up and realize that and make common cause across the lines that so often separate us. Both faculty and janitors are seen as labor costs to be minimized and considered easily replaceable. Okay. Currently, 70% of teaching hours at universities nationwide are performed by part-time contingent faculty. 70%. I mean, that's a shocking figure, I think. And it really gets to the heart of the problem. In Indianapolis, 80% of hotel workers don't actually work for the hotels where they labor. They work for outsourcing companies. Hospitality Staffing Solutions employs 10,000 hotel workers in Indianapolis, most of whom make barely over minimum wage, and many of whom are victims of wage theft on a regular basis. And by 2002, 61% of colleges had outsourced their food service. I'm sure that figure is much higher. That's a 10-year-old figure. It must be much higher by now. Faculty need to combine the nuanced arguments that we're used to making with simple, bold statements that reveal the corporate agenda behind the trend toward privatization of our public institutions. Okay? Put simply, privatization is a theft of public resources. It's an attempt to capture the common wealth to serve the private greed. And outsourcing is a convenient way for the university to shirk its responsibilities to its employees and to shift even more costs to the students. But pointing out the connections is the easy part. The challenge is to use these common concerns to organize effectively across the traditional lines of status that divide workers at the university and separate the university from the community. Okay? So at IUPUI a year ago, we organized a panel discussion that brought together associate faculty, part-time faculty, who are beginning to organize for better pay and working conditions, with downtown hotel workers who were employed by an outsourcing firm. Both groups are victims of this trend toward outsourcing that makes their employment uncertain. And when we get them together on this panel discussion, they told very similar stories about a lack of respect on the job, inadequate resources to do their job properly, and the stress that this work situation put on themselves and their families. The students who were in attendance at that session learned that their education was being compromised by a system that charged them more, even as it spent less money on their instruction. When people begin to see their individual problems are similar to others, they begin to change personal problems into social issues that can be addressed through collective action. In this case, associate faculty members became active supporters of the drive to unionize the downtown hotels. And also the recently successful drive to organize campus food service workers. And they met in small groups with these workers to exchange their stories after the public forum. They wrote letters of support. They went on delegations to management. And they really began to feel the connections that they had because of their work situation and to work together. And so I think what we need to do really, in opposition to the barriers that stand between workers, we need to develop a narrative of the university as an extended family. And like a family, we have an obligation to look out for one another and speak up whenever one group on campus is threatened. Faculty can bring students, labor organizers, and workers together by designing service learning and internship opportunities that focus on building connections between the different groups. At IUPUI, students have been working with Unite Here to organize the food service workers and to build community support for their successful unionization campaign. Now, as the fledgling union, the very first union of food service workers on a college campus in Indiana, we're a little behind. Now, as the fledgling union seeks to build confidence and trust in its new members in its first year of existence, students and faculty are staying involved in the process by visiting union members on the job site to inquire about how their work has changed under the union contract, and also by supporting unionization drives at other universities in Indianapolis. Another way to strengthen alliances between students, faculty, staff, and unions is to occupy the classroom. Well, we already occupy the classroom, right? But let's do it in a different way. On Monday, I visited an introductory anthropology class with four other people: a young organizer for Unite Here, the shop steward of the new food service workers union, a downtown hotel worker, and a student who's been involved in the unionization campaign for over a year. I gave a brief overview of labor history. The professor said she wanted the story of American labor in 10 minutes, so I did my best. Hit some of the highlights, missed a few things. I debunked some of the common misperceptions about unions, and then I introduced the concept of wage theft. And of course, about half of the students in the classroom had actually experienced wage theft, so they knew exactly what I was talking about. Stuart, the Unite Here organizer, talked about a coworker of his at the Hyatt who had complained about not being paid for all of his hours, and then was given no hours the subsequent 3 weeks. And he talked about sitting in this man's house with no heat, with no lights on, with his family there in the cold, because he was being punished for speaking up for himself. And Ava, a housekeeper at the Hyatt, who actually works for the outsourcing company rather than the Hyatt, talked about the stress and physical pain of being required to clean up to 50 hotel rooms in a single day. In Indianapolis, they do that. Without a union contract, there's not a single union hotel in Indiana. And housekeepers are required to clean up to 50 rooms in a single day. Okay? And as you know, those new beds that they have in the hotels are enormously heavy. And the strain that it puts on people is unbelievable. And of course, you can't get 50 rooms done in 8 hours. The only way you can do it, and what happens very often, is they're told to clock out and then go back to work and finish your rooms. That's a regular feature of hotel life in Indianapolis. She reported being routinely cheated out of her wages by Hospitality Staffing Solutions, and now there's a class action suit that's been filed on behalf of the workers by the union to get wage and hour violations. James, the new shop steward of the food service union at IUPUI, talked about working conditions before and after the union. Before he had the union, he was the prep cook, and there were two prep cooks, and one of them became ill. And so rather than hire someone to take her place, he was just told to, you know, increase your output, do two jobs, of course, you know, which he couldn't do, but, you know, he tried his best. Of course, after the union, they have a new sense of power, they have a contract, and they have a way to enforce it. 2 weeks ago, Chartwells, which is the private contractor that controls, has a monopoly on food service on our campus, was dragging its feet in resolving a grievance. James led a delegation to management that included faculty, staff, students, and workers, and the grievance was successfully resolved the same day. And so that's an example of that kind of thing. When, you know, when people come together and we really show that the workers are not alone, that the workers are supported by the faculty, by the students, by the staff, it makes all the difference. Lucas, a senior at IUPUI, explained that he had gotten involved with the union because he saw the workers' struggle for dignity and respect as similar to his own as a young man who suffers from cerebral palsy. By bringing these stories into the classroom and pointing out the connections between outsourcing, wage theft, and the powerlessness that most non-union workers feel on the job, we invite students to join a broad-based coalition for social and economic justice. However, to move students from sympathy and understanding to action, we also need to appeal more directly to their self-interest. Sympathy and understanding will get you so far, but you need the self-interest. You need to connect their needs with those of the university community as a whole. So I was trying to figure out how to do this, and luckily, one of the trustees at Indiana University gave me the perfect way to do this out of the kindness of his heart. William Strong is a trustee for IU that covers IUPUI, the Bloomington campus, and several other regional campuses. He's also an executive with Morgan Stanley Financial. And he came up with the idea of privatizing campus parking on both the Bloomington and the IUPUI campus. And I don't know if you've heard about the recent case at Ohio State where campus parking was privatized. And Morgan Stanley was behind that deal, too. They underwrote that deal. They were hired by the university not to determine whether it was a good idea or not. I don't know about you, but if I was going to hire a financial planner, that would be like the first thing I would ask them, is this a good deal for the university or not? No, that question was not asked. The question that they were asked was to price the parking. How much can we get for it? And then to line up the bidders. And their contract, under their contract, they only got paid if the deal went through. Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it, about how these things work. Now, at Ohio State, they have a 50-year lease in exchange for an upfront payment of $483 million. Okay? Under the deal, the contractor can raise rates 7.5% per year for the first 10 years, and then afterwards, the larger of 4% or the inflation rate in the subsequent 40 years. Average increases were about 4.5% when the university was running the parking. And so if you do the math, 7.5% increases for 10 years basically doubles the price of parking over 10 years. There was a lot of faculty and student opposition to this plan. Anybody who looks at it rationally can see that it's not a good deal for the university. In a survey, 92% of faculty who felt they knew enough about the issue to have an opinion were against it. But in spite of that, the administration went ahead and privatized the parking, accepted the money and privatized the parking. Morgan Stanley is standing in line to do the same thing at IUPUI. At IUPUI, parking is a huge issue. It always has been. In my early years teaching composition at IUPUI, I forbade my students to write about parking as a topic because I was so fed up with it. You know, it's an urban university. It's a commuter campus. It's always a crunch issue. Actually, recently, as I tell my students, they don't believe me, but I tell them parking is a lot better than it used to be because the university has built garages and tried to handle the issue. And currently, parking is run as a nonprofit part of the university. All it has to do is break even, bring enough in fees to pay the bonds on the new garages, pay for the employees, and everything else. Even currently, with the current regime, very few food service workers can afford to pay for parking. Most of them have to commute by bus, come in on bikes, walk, whatever it takes, because they can't afford to park on the very campus where they work. So the threat of paying more for parking is a real motivator. we've been able to get students really riled up about this issue. But once we get people riled up about the issue, we can use it as a motivation to understand more about how this is connected with everything else at the university and the whole move toward privatization. Another thing that I thought was funny was when the whole thing was brought up to the faculty and staff council at IUPUI, it was referred to as the monetization of parking, which I guess is corporate speak for sucking money out of the students and faculty. And the other thing that was really disturbing about this is, of course, obviously at Ohio State, it was done over the strenuous objections of just about everybody. At IUPUI, in the IU system, I should say, they convened a faculty-staff committee to look into this. You would think, good idea. But they were not charged with looking into whether it was a good idea or not. Although everyone on that committee was opposed to the idea of parking privatization, when they told that to the administration, they were told, that's not the question we asked you. We asked you, how can we make it work? Now get back to work and tell us how we can make it work. Tell us what needs to be in the contract to make it work. That, I think, is a troubling trend, because that means that there is no more faculty governance. There is no more consent at the university. We have a total corporate top-down management style being implemented. But of course, it's a great issue to organize around. So normally on Friday mornings, I'm teaching a class on organizing for social action as the introductory course to the Masarakia Scholars Program. And when this came up, we were using the Midwest Academy manual, Organizing for Social Change. I'm sure you're familiar with that and their strategy chart. And so this was a perfect example to use because the students were familiar with the issue. I had some handouts for them to give them some background and details on what was going on. And we used the Midwest strategy chart to plot a strategy against parking privatization. For the last 2 weeks, students have been circulating a petition calling on the trustees to halt any attempt to privatize parking, to submit any future privatization deals to a campus-wide referendum, and also to take a look at previous privatization deals and to do a cost-benefit analysis and to find out who's benefiting and who's losing as a result of these privatization deals. The response to the petition has been overwhelming. The first couple of days we were out there, people were, oh, where can I sign? Not only where can I sign, can I take petitions and bring to my classes, and they bring them back to me. We also gathered signatures outside President McRobbie's State of the University address that was held in Indianapolis, just to kind of fire a warning shot over the bow for the administrators and the trustees who were also in attendance to let them know that we knew what was going on, because at Ohio State, a lot of the work was done behind the scenes and it was a rushed through process. And that seemed to be what was happening at IUPUI. Faculty are talking about the issue in their classes. The word on the street is out there. Yesterday we had an event outside, beautiful 80 degree day in Indianapolis, that was an open mic that allowed members of the campus community to talk about parking privatization. In Indianapolis, we recently privatized the city's parking as well. I don't know if you heard about that, but we followed the Chicago model, disastrous as it was, and leased our parking for 50 years to an outside contractor. Of course, immediately the rates went up, the enforcement went up. I've never seen so many meter enforces as I have since it became private. There was strenuous opposition on the city council to that deal, and so one of the city councilors who'd been opposed to parking privatization downtown came to our event on campus and talked about what a mistake it had been for the city, how the money was misappropriated, and how basically it was just a scam for private corporations to funnel money out of the system. One thing I forgot to mention about the Ohio State deal, the contractor that was chosen is actually an Australian firm. So the profits not only go out of the city, out of the state, they go right out of the country. And to me, that's one of the huge problems with outsourcing in general. You know, the hotel workers in downtown Indy don't work for their hotels anymore. If they actually made the money that the hotel pays to the outsourcing company for their labor, and if we eliminated that middleman and kept that money in Indianapolis and gave it to working people who are going to spend it immediately, it would be a huge boon for our economy. But instead, that money is routinely sucked out. The staffing solutions company, although they have 10,000 people working for them in Indianapolis, they have two people on staff in Indianapolis. You can imagine the profits that they make on that kind of a deal. So these are the kind of things that we need to talk about, that we need to make people aware of, that we need to bring people together on in order to make a change. Now, obviously, we have a long way to go, both on fighting privatization and especially on the more ambitious goal of restoring the public mission of public higher education. I'll conclude by sketching in a plan to create a campus-wide movement to fight the corporate agenda. Most importantly, we need to build solidarity among the different constituencies at the university through common issues like parking, affordability, quality of education, and respect for all workers. I think we also need to promote strong student unions. That's something that's totally absent here. And they were a backbone of the Quebec student movement. They already had organized unions. And so when the proposal to increase fees by what, by American standards, seem like rather small amounts, much less than what we're paying, I think tuition would have gone from about $2,500 Canadian to about $3,500 Canadian under this plan. But because they were organized and united, they succeeded in fighting back those tuition hikes. We need to organize the employees at the university. We have very few union employees at IUPUI. We have a small AskMe chapter that's mainly confined to the maintenance crew. And when I was speaking with the president of that chapter yesterday at our event, I asked him, you know, how many parking employees do you have? And he was like, oh, I don't think we have any. I was like, you know, maybe you should organize them, you know? And that's what I'm gonna propose to him when I get back, is to say, look, my students are excited about this issue. They wanna organize the parking employees against privatization. At the same time, can we get them to sign union cards for you? What can the union do for them to protect them from this threat? Because of course, the first thing a private company will do when they come in is fire the current employees and hire people at minimum wage. That's how they develop profits out of the privatization scheme. I think we need to organize employees into one big union. Chris, here, Jim already, John already mentioned how my last talk was about Joe Hill and the Wobblies. I think that idea needs to come back. Now, obviously, I realize labor law makes that rather difficult. They like to divide us up into little different segments and things like that. But we have to remember that labor laws like that were written for the express purpose of keeping workers apart. And we can't let bad laws interfere with good organizing. And I think what's important about organizing at the university is bringing everybody together in one big union to show that our issues are the same. We need to reach out to the parents of our students as well as to the students and to a broader public and convince them that higher education is a public good. I don't think we can let the right wing win that argument, because if we do, we're on the way down as public universities. Because once that idea is cemented in people's minds, you get the idea, well, why should I pay more taxes for a public university when they can raise tuition whenever they want? You know? And if the university, in response to that, raises tuition, you just reinforce the same negative cycle. And if we allow ourselves to get caught into that cycle, then we're never going to dig ourselves out of this hole. So some people may say it's unrealistic to expect states to pay more for public higher education. Perhaps it is. But what I say is, unless we do that, we're never going to be able to get out of the problem that we're in. I think once we've built a broad-based coalition, we need to take it to the legislature. We need to demand that funding, okay? Because otherwise, we're never going to be able to fight back and restore the democratic promise of an affordable, quality, public higher education for all qualified students. So, there. Thank you. Yeah, I'd love comments and questions and ideas.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think there's a parallel that has been steadily going downhill.
Right.
And that's a tough approach. They're very hard to work with. This university has tried three times and lost them all.
Yeah. You would think, yeah.
And so it's like hurting cats.
Yeah.
But the, so I just wonder.
It is. No, I know.
How do you get tenured faculty to recognize and be conscious of their own interests?
Yeah.
Because in the long haul, they are being replaced.
Yeah.
And it's not only
the
non-tenured faculty, fixture.
Right.
Who are coming
yeah.
in, but their actual numbers, in many ways,
absolutely. Are in decline, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I think the problem with that is, well, you know, my position is secure. I'm fine. I don't want to rock the boat. It's, you know, and the pain is being inflicted on the incoming generation. And I think that's what makes it so hard to get to motivate people. I don't have a magic answer. I wish I did. And one thing I think, you know, that just come up on our campus is they've decided to hike our health premiums 43% in 1 year. If that doesn't motivate people, then I don't know what will. But I think really what you have to do, a good friend of mine who's an organizer who was with Unite Here and is now with the AFL-CIO in Indiana, said that she finds that organizing people around their self-interest is one thing, but very often people are more willing to do something if they see it benefiting not just themselves, but somebody else. And like if we put it in terms of saving the university, I think that could have some resonance. But
just one point that is in doing some organizing myself, one of the key factors this year, I think, is what I call the grandparent crisis. And that is that as school boards cut back on school facilities and so on, increasingly the number of people who turn up are characterized by grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Proletariat, exactly. Part-time, replaceable.
And I think it's a wedge.
Yeah.
It works.
No, it is, yeah.
Let me just throw in two quick asides and see what other people have as well. I think it was interesting that we have a ballot proposition by folks who want to limit tax increases to have a two-thirds majority in the legislature. Before there can be a tax increase. What's interesting is that one of the proponents was on the radio yesterday and kept on saying, you know, the truth of the matter is the governor has to understand that we have to get beyond tax and spend government.
To what kind of government, right? It's such a fundamental attack. It's just,
It is a fundamental attack, and it's this whole attack on the notion of, I think, especially where you started with, the whole notion of what is the public sphere and what is the public space. But I thought that you might be interested in other people who are interested, but no. That there was an attack in our state legislature on higher education involvement in exactly what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because internships at the University of Michigan and the College of Social Work, some of them were connected to the resident organizers in Rock and Detroit.
Yeah.
They threatened some of the right-wing legislators, threatened higher ed budget generally over the fact that there was any involvement.
Sure.
By academe in relation to giving any form of support to organized labor.
Yeah.
And just those of us who teach labor courses were a little, you know, were thinking maybe we were the ones being targeted, but no, that's not. The students were being targeted.
Oh, the students.
Because the role that students play as interns.
Yeah.
So with that, other comments or questions? Yes.
Organizing student unions. I'm not sure I understood what you meant by that.
Well, in Quebec, I actually went to university in Quebec. I went to McGill back in the 80s, and they had a union of students, and it was to protect the rights of students. I wasn't very much involved in it at the time because there wasn't a whole lot going on in those days in terms of organizing. But yeah, it's similar to that, but it's more militant and more focused on improving the status of education and protecting the affordability of education than it is about, you know, who's going to be president of the student body and that sort of thing. Yeah, and they organize across between universities as well. So they have unions that are not just at one particular university, but that span the province.
Do we have any models for that?
Excuse me? Do we have models for that? Not that I know of. And it isn't something I've studied in a great deal, but I think it's a promising idea. It's something that we need to do.
Well, I think that there were examples of that in 1960, so that there was formal student government in a lot of campuses, but the anti-war movement and others, the folks created student unions as an alternative to student government because they thought that student government was too state and conservative. So that, yeah. That there was Berkeley student union and other campuses.
Yeah. When you have, you know, Students for a Democratic Society, that's the group that we're trying to organize at IUPUI as kind of an umbrella for all this organizing that we want to do.
I helped bring them to a small campus in Indiana about 7 years.
Oh, really? Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, thanks for a great talk. We need you on campus here.
Right.
It seems to me that what we need is also maybe not a panacea, but we need industry unionism in higher education.
Right, right.
Now, industry unionism is never a panacea.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Sure. Right.
But at the moment, there's not this sort of industry-wide alternative that could bring in technical staff and faculty and adjuncts.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about that idea as a goal?
I think that's exactly what we need, because that's the only way to get enough of a critical mass to really get the administration to pay attention. You know, you look at these examples where they pretend to have a faculty committee giving them guidance on a decision when they've already taken the decision. You know, and unless we get together, we're never going to be able to turn that around. And, you know, recently at the University of Oregon, they organized a union that included both full-time and part-time faculty. And I think that's something that we really need to do, is to combine those two. And to really help the full-time faculty see that the part-time faculty, they really are our colleagues, and that we really do need to support them, and we need to get together if we're going to have a chance to do anything. But I would even want to go beyond that model to something like you were talking, to bring in the professional staff as well. Because these people, I mean, at IUPUI, these people are scared. The staff people are very scared. When I go with a petition to them, they're like, oh, you know, I think privatization is a terrible idea, but I don't dare sign a petition. I don't want to put my name down or anything like that. Because they're just like workers everywhere. They're afraid that if they speak up, they're going to get slapped down. They're going to get fired. And so I think overcoming that fear is one of the great things about pulling everybody together in the same union. Tenured faculty tend not to have quite as much fear of being dismissed over this kind of activity, although there is that, and they're hard to motivate. But I think if we can pull together that way, we can provide cover for one another. I mean, that's one of the things that I like about the community campaigns that I've been involved with the Unite Here, especially in Indianapolis, is they realize that workers are afraid. And what they've found is that by bringing members of the community along and saying, you know, we're behind you, we have your back, we're watching out for this, by doing things like workers' rights boards through Jobs with Justice that I'm also involved with, we let workers see that, you know, there is somebody who's watching. Now, those workers' rights boards don't have the force of law. They can't make a decision. They can't go after the employee. But they can bring these issues out into the light, and they can make workers feel like there is somebody who's on my side, who's paying attention to these things. And I think those are the kind of things that we need to begin developing. I don't know. I don't think so. Right. Yeah. Right. It does, yeah. It does. Yeah. Could, yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, I'm only beginning to think about organizing faculty. Right, 5 years before I came to IUPUI in the mid-80s, there was an attempt to organize a union at IUPUI. One of my good friends who's actually teaching my class for me today was one of the leaders of that, and so he's told me a lot about it. And they had good support in the liberal arts. They had some support in sciences. And then when it came to defining the bargaining unit, the administration said, oh, and we're going to include the medical school, too, where they had no support at all, very conservative faculty, and that was the end of it. And frankly, over the last 7 years, my thinking has been, well, you know, look at these hotel workers. They need a union a heck of a lot more than we do. Lately, I've been thinking, not so much. We need a union too. And so I'm only beginning to kind of work out, you know, how we can unionize. But yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating because, I mean, most faculty members are too, I mean, they have too much of a bourgeois orientation. They're not willing to pigeonhole other people in their offices, you know, and to have those one-on-one conversations that you really need to build a union. We're much more comfortable, you know, sending out a memo or signing on to something, but to actually do the hard work of talking to people and telling them why they need to be in the union, it's hard to motivate people to do that. I think some of the younger people at IUPUI are showing some promise. We'll see. Yeah.
Other Rick?
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I don't know, but I mean that's what we need to do. I think it's, you know, questions of status and things like that.
Just an aside, just so that we get the, you know, kind of facts out on the table. Michigan State and University of Michigan are the only two institutions in the state that are not unionized. So Eastern, Western, Northern, Central, okay, are all organized, many of them either by AEUP as a bargaining unit, and in some cases they're NEA units, you know. So that what's interesting is that a lot of these campuses have fought over on the local level a lot of the same kinds of things and using their faculty union to try to do that. But I think that one natural thing that makes sense is that this is one place where administrators, frankly, and faculty actually have a lot in common, is the notion that universities are a good thing, right? I mean, that there should be common cause over the fact that, you know, the actual share of state funding that's going into universities declines every year. And in many state universities, Penn State is one example, I think Penn State is now down around 15% or less of their overall budget comes from the state. At one point on the state campus, campus at Penn State, one faculty member raised, why don't we just go, I mean, the truth of the matter is, why do we even care what a state legislature says if in fact we get so little money from it?
Yeah.
I mean, so there's all sorts of tendencies and counter-tendencies, but, I mean, you know, Neil knows organizing since he helped organize the non-tenured faculty here. You know, the weird faculty here at Michigan State, we're the only non-union group. Every other group of workers on campus is
organized.
Yeah.
And the fixed-term faculty are organized in almost all of the other campuses, including Michigan State. And at the University of Michigan, the Electric Employees Organization, and here, and the other regions, you know, the regional organizations as well. So it's gone quite a ways in Michigan. And there's been quite a bit of support. The AFT especially has been very active in the statewide election and pushing the proposal to and so on and so forth, but a major player at this time, which hasn't occurred in the
past. Other questions or comments? Julia, have you had any?
Well, I just thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was a great presentation.
Thanks.
I've been at the university for about 10 years now, a full-time fixed-term faculty member, but I come from corporate America. Mm. And so I found university as kind of a really weird culture, because my headset has always been kind of a corporate America headset, which is really a very insecure situation.
Right. Absolutely, because it's creeping up on us slowly.
It'll be too late.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm really, really concerned about that, because I being a fixed-term faculty member and feeling very powerless, like you say, the tenure-track faculty are, in my mind, they're the answer to my problems.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, it's a question of waking people up to what's going on, because it has crept in over the last 40 years, little by little.
I think your point about the creating that narrative is so critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. So much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, with that, why don't we give Tom another quick round of applause?
Thank you.